This is Basic Theory 2, Unit 10, Part 3, Heat-Related Emergencies. Alrighty, so, let's talk about the pathogenesis of heat-related illness. Not a great word, pathogenesis. I love that. Okay, so three primary mechanisms for heat-related illnesses. Exogenous heat gain, which means... Nope. That would be endogenous. Sorry?
Heat from an outside source.
Heat from an outside source, exactly. Increased endogenous heat production, which would be fever.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. So exo, just remember, outside, and endo, inside. Or decreased heat dispersion. Right. So, and that can be an age-related thing. That can be atmospheric condition thing, as we talked about before. So any factors that increase the amount of heat produced or diminishes heat dissipation can potentially result in heat-related illness or heat-related stress. Alrighty. So examples of exogenous heat gain would be things like high ambient temperature, high ambient humidity. And do you remember at what humidity level, what percentage do we stop evaporating sweat? 75%, yeah, good. You remember it. Heat waves predispose to heat stroke epidemics. And of course, the people most at risk of heat stroke are the most vulnerable populations, the elderly, the young, the disabled, all right? And the best indicator for environmental heat stress is something called the wet bulb temperature, which factors in the effect of humidity on the temperature. So just like wind chill in the cold, you know, when the news report says it's going to be 28 degrees with a humidity of 65%, you know, it's going to feel more like 30 degrees with the humidity, right? So a number of agencies, including the military, use a wet bulb globe temperature as a guide for recommended activity levels. Endogenous heat production would occur as a result of, for example, a febrile illness. And being febrile is in a lot of ways a good thing because it helps kill the pathogen. So, you know, the big question is, do we want to get that temperature under control? And the current treatment in most hospitals, most emergency departments, nurses will tell you, give the kid some Tylenol. But I wouldn't give my kid Tylenol unless she was really uncomfortable, because the whole idea is to kill the pathogen, right? And so keeping a temperature up is a good thing. So when you're febrile, when you're fighting a pathogen, a bacteria or a virus or something, your metabolic rate increases, and that results in an increase in heat production and other conditions that can result in increased metabolism include hyperthyroid states. Now, by far, the most common thyroid condition you're going to encounter in the field is hypothyroidism. You're going to see a lot of patients who have hypothyroidism, and they're on synthroxin or Synthroid or some sort of drug for hypothyroidism. Very unusual to encounter a patient with hyperthyroidism, just FYI. But they're predisposed to heat illness. Physical activity increases body temperature, core temperature, and that can result in increased endogenous heat production. So, and if they happen to be in an environment that impedes heat loss somehow, exercise can increase the core temperature by as much as a degree Celsius every 5 minutes. So, you know, we talk about football players who are wearing a helmet and a lot of gear. You know, their temperature, they may not be able to dissipate that heat. And if they're exercising vigorously, that can be a dangerous thing. So, you know, increasingly we're seeing, I mean, over the years we've seen so many athletes drop from the heat, but particularly football players practicing in the hot sun. And more schools and universities and colleges are establishing rules around, you know, when you can practice certain sports and given the outside temperature, or just how much activity you should be doing given the outside temperature, for that reason, because you know, colleges and universities are facing lawsuits from parents of kids who die. Pharmacological agents, certain pharmacological agents can increase endogenous heat temperature. Not many, but certain anesthetics in patients who have something called malignant hyperthermia, and certain antipsychotic drugs as well. So you see a lot of patients on antipsychotic drugs. It doesn't mean that they're homicidal, but you'll see a lot of elderly patients on antipsychotic drugs. Because sometimes Alzheimer's and dementia results in some degree of psychosis. And that can increase endogenous heat production, which is a problem because they're already elderly and that's an issue. But a very small percentage of patients have malignant hyperthermia. And so if you go in for an OR procedure, one of the first things the anesthesiologist will ask you is, do you have a history of malignant hyperthermia, or does your family have a history of it? Anyone in your family, because then they have to be careful which anesthetic drugs they give you. Other pharmacological agents. So any one of the group of drugs we categorize as sympathomimetics. So the sympathetic nervous system, as you know, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, you can think of them as kind of a foot on the gas pedal, which is the sympathetic, and a foot on the brake, which is the parasympathetic. And in terms of your parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems, they work in tandem. So it's like having one foot on the gas, one foot on the brake at all times. And if you put your foot down the accelerator, you increase the speed of the car, and you increase metabolism when you take a sympathomimetic like cocaine or any amphetamines or tricyclic antidepressants, which are an older class of antidepressants, increase endogenous heat production by directly stimulating the hypothalamus, increasing muscle contractions, increasing heart rate, increasing metabolism in general. In fact, in cocaine poisoning, the cause of death and the cause of convulsions in cocaine use is typically excess heat production. So they get a very high core temperature. And if you ever get someone who's been using cocaine or has taken a cocaine overdose, and they're extremely agitated and they're extremely hot, one of the best things you can do is cool them down. Now, I wouldn't hose them down, but when you get them on the stretcher, I'd get layers of clothing off and irrigate them with normal saline to cool them down. Maybe even get some ice packs underneath the armpits if you can get them cooperative enough. If you can start an intravenous line, you give them cool fluids. Room temperature normal saline, normal saline at 20 degrees Celsius in a patient whose temperature is 39, 40, 42 degrees Celsius will cool them down pretty quickly, a 10 cc per kilo bolus or so. And actually cooling in a cocaine overdose is more likely to be life-saving than giving them sedatives. But if you're working with an ACP, you'll want to cool them down and give them sedatives. LSD and phencyclidine act on the central nervous system to induce a hypermetabolic state. Again, we classify these as sympathomimetics. And monoamine oxidase inhibitors, we rarely see these anymore. These are antidepressant drugs that are rarely used in patients who don't respond to any other form of antidepressant. Have you been following, do you guys follow medical stuff in social media? Have you seen any articles about intranasal ketamine for depression? Any of you seen those? Haven't, eh?
Recently for the delirium.
Excited delirium, yeah. Yeah, so ACPs are giving it for excited delirium, yeah. Matt?
Every one of the ketamine treatments, a lot of people have been saying it's like changed their life. There's been quite a lot of buzz around it.
Oh, yeah. Should never use the word buzz and recreational pharmaceuticals in the same sentence. yeah, it's interesting. So I don't know what the research has said. I've just seen some messages floating around social media. But we've never really talked about social media much and who to follow and what to who to follow on Facebook or podcasts or anything like that. We should do that. I should send you attachment of recommended people to follow on Facebook, groups to follow on Facebook, and people to follow on people in organizations to follow on Twitter. How many of you are on Twitter, just out of curiosity? Just one, two, three. Three of you, that's it? Yeah. How many of you have no idea what the benefit of Twitter is? You're just thinking, what's the point? Because I didn't see a point either for years. And two friends of mine kept bugging me over and over, get on Twitter. But what I discovered on Twitter is that, so it's like a little news briefs, right, in your Twitter feed. And, 140 to 240 characters. And what I discovered was that if I follow some of the smartest emergency physicians on the planet and some really good medical organizations, I'll see feeds with links to, you know, research paper that was just published yesterday or a new drug that's just been released. And it really keeps you on the cutting edge of sort of what's happening in the medical world, the medical field. I have two Twitter accounts. I have a paramedic underscore tutor account where I follow all the medical staff, and I have an EdTech medic account where I follow a whole bunch of virtual, augmented, mixed reality people and companies to see what's going on there. And the news that you get from the Twitter feeds is just phenomenal, including things like this intranasal ketamine for depression, which is a new treatment for people who don't respond well to other antidepressants. And ketamine's a pretty nice drug. Salicylates, like ASA, will increase metabolism. Salicylates actually cause stimulation of skeletal muscles and release of CO2 from skeletal muscles, which is a problem. Paracetamol, which is an antibacterial agent, increases metabolic heat production. And in terms of heat dissipation or dispersion, there's seven primary factors that impair the body's ability to disperse or dissipate heat. And those are, number one, dehydration. And I like to think of dehydration this way. If you drive a car and you lose water from your radiator, what happens to your engine? It overheats. If you're a human body and you're losing a lot of water, you overheat. Same thing, same principle. If you're really, really cold and you want to gain heat, you try to get rid of water. You know how you do that? You pee. So when I used to go on winter survival courses, which was a requirement when I worked on the helicopter, every few years we'd go on a winter survival course. We'd sleep out in the snow. We'd build these lean-tos and build a fire, and we'd sleep in sleeping bags and close to the fire. You would pee, because you felt the urge to pee on a frequent basis. They call that hypothermic micturition. And I had to pee, no word of a lie, literally every half hour. So I just kept peeing and peeing and peeing and peeing and peeing and peeing. It's probably TMI, but and imagine having to pee, having to pull your pants all the way down to pee. That wasn't the case for me, but imagine having to do that. That's not fun. So my group was three close friends of mine, one guy and two girls. And I remember this is my first Witcher Survival course in Deseronto, Ontario. And we had this lean-to, and we took shifts. So we two people slept, and the other two people stayed awake to stoke the fire to make sure the fire kept going. And I went to sleep, and I didn't sleep well, and I was I was so exhausted. And I would wake up because someone was whacking me on the head. And I'm thinking, what the fuck is going on here? And they whack me on the head, and I wake up delirious, whack on the head. And turns out my friend Paula was hitting me on the head because I was sleeping a little close to the fire. My toque kept catching fire. So she kept waking me up. At the end of that weekend course, my first winter survival course, the next survival course wasn't as bad because we were better prepared for it, but at the end of that weekend winter survival course in Deseronto, we all got in the same car. We drove on the 401, and we saw a hotel. We went to the hotel. We checked in, all four of us, just for the day. We had the buffet breakfast, And then we went upstairs and we showered, like one after another, and had a nap for about 5 or 6 hours, and then drove the rest of the way home. It was such a brutal, brutal survival weekend. I don't know why anyone camp in the winter. That's just nuts. Anyway, so.
You offended Matt.
What's that?
You offended Matt.
Yeah, no, I didn't offend Matt. Matt's just a hardier guy than me, that's all. So dehydration decreases your ability to dissipate heat. Cardiovascular disease, extremes of age, obesity. When you're overweight, you're insulated. I lost 40 pounds since November, and I actually get cold now occasionally, which is really bizarre. Like sometimes in my house, I'm actually cold. I've never experienced that before. And I'm afraid of losing another 20, 30 pounds because I'll be like, you know, wrapped in a onesie or something. And improper clothing, skin diseases, and certain drugs as well. So let's talk about the different types of heat illness. Now, this is one we don't get 911 calls for, but heat edema. Does anyone get swollen hands or feet when they're really in hot weather? Do you? Yeah. I get swollen hands when the summer comes initially, but then it goes down once you acclimatize. So it's a self-limiting process, mild swelling with tightening of the hands and feet, and appears the first few days exposed to hot environment. Most commonly in the elderly and non-acclimatized individuals who are physically active after a prolonged period of sitting. So sometimes seen in healthy travelers coming from a colder climate. On rare occasions, you see pitting edema in the ankles. Now, if any of you guys are in the hospital now, right? Have any of you seen pitting edema? How many of you seen pitting edema? Okay. So the rest of you, it's your mission to find pitting edema, right?
I found pulses paradoxes.
Good.
I thought of you.
You thought of me, eh? It's nice.
Rob.
Radio pulse. Just like Rob said. Disappears with a breath in and reappears with a breath out. So honestly, one year in clinical, you're going to be in clinical now in next semester, I would make a list, a shopping list of things you want to see. Like you want to experience, you want to palpate pulsus paradoxus, you want to find pitting edema, you want to find some mastoid bruising. You're going to go shopping for these things. So you're going to look for them, right? It keeps you busy. It keeps you thinking. And you can ask the nurses. You know, my teacher told me about this thing called pulsus paradoxus. Is there anyone on this floor who might have, like, bronchospasm with pulsus paradoxus? Who's your teacher? Rob Terrio. Whatever. Yeah, so you should go looking for things. Typically resolves in a few days, maybe as long as 6 weeks, but rarely. No treatment necessary. It's not a call. So heat syncope is a sort of a variation of postural hypotension. It's a vasovagal episode. If someone's at risk of vasovagal, the risk is a little bit higher with the heat. Most commonly in unacclimatized individuals. We get called a lot for syncope. And the only challenge with syncope is determining whether this is something benign or something more serious. And did we talk about red flag syncopes last semester? I can't recall. No? Okay, so there's certain red flag syncopes where we always transport to hospital. And in fact, even vasovagals we usually transport. But if they're over 40 or a PED, those would be red flag syncopes. Other ones include if it's exertional syncope, it's not normal to exercise and syncopize. That's not at all normal. That could signify something like a cardiomyopathy. If there's any history of dysrhythmias, or if they've got any cardiac history, coronary artery disease, if they're on certain meds like beta blockers and calcium channel blockers. There's a long list of red flag syncopes, and if I didn't talk about it last semester, I'll get to it at some point. when you're assessing, you really can't rule out any sort of nearest neurological, metabolic, or cardiovascular disorders when it comes to syncope. So we treat them all fairly seriously. You know, some people just say, I just fainted, it's no biggie. But and we also have to assess them for trauma, right? Because if they fainted, they may have injured their head or fractures or something, or injured themselves in one way or another. So treatment for heat-related illness of any kind is, number one, get them out of the heat, right? Don't spend time in the hot sun talking with them. Help them up onto the stretcher, get them into the back of your air-conditioned ambulance. And even if they're telling you, I don't need to go to the hospital, I'll just say, well, let's go in the back of the ambulance. And if they want to walk, that's fine. I'll just hold them by the arm or put them on the stretcher, get in the back of the ambulance where it's cool. And then we can talk and we can take a history, we can do an assessment, right? And decide from there whether or not they're going to go to the hospital. So we may rehydrate heat syncope. Now, if you've got any heat-related, if someone has any heat-related illness that someone felt warranted a 911 call, the one liquid we don't give them is water. Because what happens in heat is we sweat, we lose salt, and we drink water to replenish, and oftentimes we've lost salt, so we become hyponatremic, so low serum salt level, and then you get a further dilutional hyponatremia from drinking water. My general rule is, at the point where you've had about 4 bottles of water, it's time to switch to something that's electrolyte balanced, something with some electrolytes in it, right, like potassium and salt and so on and so forth, without endorsing any brand names, a Gatorade, even a soda pop or something. Yeah.
I know they use like Pedialyte for kids. Is that any
good for adults? Oh yeah. Yeah, Pedialyte would be great. Yeah. Yeah, because it's a nice electrolyte balanced solution. Yeah, for sure. It doesn't taste too bad either. I tried to encourage my daughter to drink it once by showing her me drinking it, and it's really good. Come on. Then I put some Poulet in it, and that improved things a bit. Rest, of course, helps transport and monitor ECG. Heat cramps, this is painful involuntary spasmodic contractions of the skeletal muscles. We had a girl here at the Camp Bucko Combat Challenge, which is a pre-service fire challenge, and she, at the end of this challenge, which is a grueling, grueling challenge, far more brutal than it should be, she started to get muscle contractions and almost seizure-like activity. She was just, her legs were spasming, her arm muscles were spasming. We had to call 911 for her because there was nothing we could do for her. And she probably just needed electrolytes restored, right? Calcium, potassium, salt, and so on and so forth. So the cramps in the calves, the thighs, the shoulders, we see this in half marathons, we see this in people at outdoor rock concerts who drink too much water and nothing that's electrolyte balanced. And hyponatremia is the biggest risk for people in the heat outdoors from marathons or outdoor concerts or air shows and things like that, because hyponatremia can lead to seizures. And so you gotta get a little bit of salt content there. Nothing too salty, but at least some salt in there. So sweating is profuse, person drinks water, other hypotonic solutions, and cramps may occur during exercise or after latent periods several hours later. Generally considered self-limiting, but we might get a 911 call if it looks significant. And so it may require an emergency room visit. So the exact pathogenesis is not clear. So it's probably related to hyponatremia, probably related to some extent to a hypocalcemia, so low serum calcium as well. And and relative deficiencies of other electrolytes like potassium as well. So treatment for heat cramps, rest, cool environment, fluid and salt replacements, your average commercial drinks with some electrolytes. If you're going to what's that concert in Barrie, Boots and Hearts, yeah, this summer? Any of you thinking of going? Yeah, my daughter really wants to go. Can someone take her?
If you pay for my ticket, yeah. Do you volunteer for it?
Really, eh? Yeah. Oh, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
They do all the meds.
Yeah, yeah. I should do that too. That'd be fun. I'll join you guys.
They pay like $15 an hour. I don't know why you
do. Just for fun. See the concert for free. No other reason. What's that?
So you work like one or two nights.
Oh, yeah? That's cool.
And then you have to deal with other drunk people.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm?
A lot of science.
I'll go. You're a drunk guy.
Yeah, great. All right, so at a place like Boots and Hearts, middle of the day, a lot of what you get is drunks, but you get dehydrated people, right? Dehydrated people who drink too much water, get hyponatremic, and they get into trouble. Heat cramps, heat stroke, heat illness, and so on and so forth. Heat tetany is characterized by hyperventilation, results in a respiratory alkalosis and some paresthesia, so paresthesia like numbness, tingling, and carpopedal spasm. Heat tetany is usually associated with short periods of intense heat, and the treatment is get them out of the hot area, eventually they may settle down when they cool, and they need to be rehydrated. So that might be intravenous fluids, just getting them to drink some electrolyte balance solution of some sort. Now, if you start an IV on them, there's no protocol for this. You can't give them 20 cc per kilo or 10 cc per kilo because you're not dealing with blood pressure issue. So you'd have to patch to the base hospital and say, I've got someone who's been in the heat for the last 6 hours. They're complaining of the following. And the doc will say, okay, give them a 10 cc per kilo bolus and then run it at 200 mLs an hour or something. So, heat exhaustion is described as someone who's been in the heat, who's dizzy, weak, malaise, lightheadedness, fatigue, nausea, vomiting, headache, myalgias. What's a myalgia? Yeah.
It's like nerve pains.
It's like what?
Like nerve pains.
No, it's not nerve pain. Myo. Muscle pain, yeah. Muscle pain. I mean, ultimately it is nerves, but it's muscle pain. Arthralgia, what would that be? Joint pain, yeah. Heat exhaustion may result in syncope or orthostatic hypotension, so near syncope, sinus tachycardia, tachypnea, diaphoresis, hyperthermia. Core temperatures are variable, but can range from normal to 40 degrees Celsius. Mental status typically remains normal and characterized by a combination of salt and water depletion. Heat exhaustion treatment, get them into cooler environments, remove layers of clothing, turn the air conditioning on high, cover them with wet sheets if you really need to during transport, but you don't want to do shivering because shivering produces heat, right? So a volume of electrolyte replacement, so IV fluids. When I say rapid amounts of IV fluids, so we're talking about maybe a liter over an hour, not over 10 minutes. So heat stroke is life-threatening, and it's rare that you'll see heat stroke, but just know that if you've got someone who's been exposed to heat for a period of time and they've got altered mental status, you start to worry about heat stroke. Now, any altered mental status, what diagnostic tool are we going to use?
Glucose.
We're always going to check for glucose. Any altered mental status, check for glucose. So if they're not hypoglycemic, then we worry about heat stroke. And we worry about heat stroke, particularly if they're not sweating, wearing heavy clothing, and they've been exposed to heat for a long period of time. We particularly worry about young kids and the elderly. But what happens in heat stroke is proteins denature, proteins in the brain, proteins in other part of the body. So it destabilizes phospholipids and lipoproteins. And if you think about denaturing protein, you want to know what denaturing protein looks like? Crack an egg. Put it in the frying pan, watch it turn from like a gel to a solid white. That's what denatured protein is. So think about that happening in your body and in your brain. Not good, right? Not good. It can liquefy membrane lipids, leading to cardiovascular collapse, multi-organ failure, and ultimately death. This might be a good case of seizure, coma, death, right? Hyponatremia, seizure, coma, death. Not good. So heat stroke is defined as the a triad of hyperpyrexia, so core temperature typically greater than 40.5 degrees Celsius, CNS dysfunction, so any altered mental status, and anhydrosis, so lack of sweating. So maybe they were sweating before and now they're not, but it's lack of sweating is not an absolute diagnostic criterion. But if you're overdressed, like in football gear, you may not have the ability to sweat. If the temperature is 75% humidity or greater, you may not have the, you might be sweating, but you may not have the ability to evaporate. So heat stroke should be suspected in anyone with a heat exposure. Hyperthermia, CNS dysfunction, such as syncope, irritability, bizarre behavior, combativeness, hallucinations, coma. I've seen three or four heat strokes where people were just acting bizarre, just bizarre behavior, just not themselves. And so the cerebellum is highly sensitive to heat, and so one of the early signs of heat stroke is ataxia, so a staggered gait. So what you might think is a drunk, right, at Boots and Hearts, because you're going there, right? No, not you, but you're going there to look after drunks with your company, right? With not your company, but the company. Be careful not to assume they're drunk. They could have heat stroke, so always approach patients with an open mind. Right? Or they could be drunk and have heat stroke, right? Because even drunk people get sick, injured, and suffer heat-related problems. So presence of sweating doesn't exclude the diagnosis. This is they experience a total breakdown of the thermoregulation, and two forms have been described, exertional and non-exertional. The exertional is typically football players or anyone working really hard with a lot of gear. Camp Bucco, pre-service fire competition is a good example. They're wearing their bunker gear and they're working really, really hard. That's a bad combination, very bad combination. This is why firefighters typically, and anyone who knows more about firefighting than me can correct me, but typically spend no more than about 20 to 30 minutes in the fire, and then they come out and they go through rehabilitation before they can go back in again. So classic or non-exertional heat stroke usually happens summer heat waves, the poor, the very young, the elderly, and the chronically ill are at greatest risk. And exertional heat stroke usually strikes young patients and people who perform physical labor or exercise in a hot, humid climate. Sorry, this is all backwards. But the treatment is largely supportive. The two key things with heat-related illness is cool them down, give them fluids. If they refuse intravenous therapy and they refuse transport, then make sure they get some electrolyte balance solution. So find that from whatever, you know, friend, a relative, get someone to buy some at the concession stand at the rock concert or whatever, and stay there, watch them drink it. Take your time, watch them drink it. If they're really, really hot, they may need cold packs on the axilla, the groin, neck, and the head. IV fluids would be the best, but you want to administer them judiciously. So we're not looking at a 20 cc per kilo bolus over 15 minutes. We're looking at, number one, probably have to patch to base hospital, get an order. The order is probably going to be give them 500 cc's over half an hour or something, or give them a liter over an hour. If you're starting a line on them, you got to transport them. I mean, obviously you can't transport them against the will, but you got to do everything possible to persuade them to go to the hospital. So you need to repeat reassessments of their temperature as you go along. Any questions about heat-related illness? So just review, you know, the distinction between heat cramps, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke. Those are the key ones. Yeah, Brock?
So you made reference to football players.
Yeah.
Getting heat exhaustion because they're working on stuff.
Yeah.
Another population of people you can refer to are furries.
Furries.
Oh, yeah.
So I did a medical at an inpatient for a few years.
Yeah.
Every May, it's like 35 degrees.
Yeah.
And people are walking around outside, so they get to wait in line for 4 hours to get inside the building.
Yeah.
Wearing their bear and like fox suits and stuff.
That's
and
awesome.
Like collapsed under a tree somewhere.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know,
they're not normal, Rob. They like go in like parks and start banging in costumes. It's out of control.
And then at nighttime there's the furry rave. Good. At least
a furry rave.
They're dancing in costume and exerting.
Yeah.
Oh, I heard Vegas is
so
like
anime. Like anime conferences.
It's called, Anime North.
Anime North. And they're wearing furry costumes.
Yes.
Okay.
Like animal costumes.
They're like dressed up as squirrels and raccoons.
And what are they? They're doing like
sexual things.
They're doing ecstasy probably.
Oh,
people, yeah. Of course they're on.
Or GHB.
They're always on drugs.
Yeah. So probably ecstasy is one of the most common ones with raves. So GHB makes them very amorous. Yeah.
Sometimes you get people who are so armored, they're wearing like
when we get
male and stuff, like plate armor costumes.
Yeah. When we get to toxicology, we'll talk about GHB and ecstasy. But one of the things I learned from a buddy of mine who used to do standbys at raves all the time is if someone collapses, like oftentimes people, not oftentimes, but sometimes people at raves have seizures and they have no history seizures. And typically it's because it's really hot in there and they're drinking a lot of fluids, so they become hyponatremic and they have a hyponatremic seizure and they're in the middle of the dance floor. But what my paramedic buddy said is never as a paramedic go out to the middle of the dance floor to get them, because everyone is on ecstasy or GHB is very amorous, so they'll be throwing themselves all over you and trying to kiss you and hug you like you described. And it's better to get security to drag them out to you. That's what I've been told. But yeah, no, trust me, I've seen teenagers on GHB. I mean, you know, one in this bed in the hospital, one in this bed, and before you know it, the two are in the same bed going at it, and you just hear in the hospital beds rocking, thinking, what's going on here, you know? Oh yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah. I just the thought of being a parent, getting a phone call, you know, saying,